Thank you very much. So first of all, I would like to thank Professor Klaus-Dieter Matthes for giving me the opportunity to participate in this symposium and to present my research here among so many esteemed scholars. And I would also, on top of that, like to use this opportunity to express my deep gratitude to the Zadra Foundation, not only for organizing and funding this event here, but also for the continuous support I've received from the foundation over the last years, especially during my studies in India. So thank you very much for that. So what I would like to present today is a short overview over some of the major themes regarding the notion of Buddha nature in the single intention, the Dampeche Gongpa Chikpa, or short Gongchik, a monumental text corpus which expounds the views of Jigong Kyopa Jigten Sumgon, or Jigten Gompo, the founder of the Jigong Kagyu lineage of Tibetan Buddhism. So since Jigten Sumgon and many of his many aspects of his presentation of Buddha nature have already been very well presented to us by Kempo Tempel and Casey Kemp over the last days, I don't think there's any further need for an introduction from my side. But let me just say a few words about the single intention, which will be the focus of my presentation today. So the root text of the single intention, which is commonly considered to be the core teaching of the Jigong Kagyu tradition, was composed in 1226 by Sherab Jungne, Jigten Sumgon's student and nephew. The text contains about 200 so-called Vajra statements, Dorje Sung, organized in seven chapters or clusters, they're called Tsum. So these Vajra statements usually consist of two parts. They first state a general or opposing opinion, and then they go on to explain Jigten Sumgon's take on the matter. So while the topics in the single intention, or the topics of these Vajra statements, generally cover the whole spectrum of Buddhist learning and practice, a few of them are directly concerned with Buddha nature. For my research, I've mainly relied on this root text of the single intention and also on the two earliest commentaries on it, namely those by Rinchen Jangchub and Dorje Sherab, two direct disciples of Jigten Sumgon. And so these two early commentaries are therefore also called the Rinjangma and the Dorje Ma, according to the authors. Apart from these two commentaries, I've also consulted texts like the great Jigong teaching to the assembly, the Jigong Tsokchu Chemo, which is a series of teachings by Jigten Sumgon that were also recorded by Sherab Jungne. And I've also relied on the essence of the Mahayana teachings, the Taichin Tengbin Ningbo by Ngoje Repa, another direct disciple of Jigten Sumgon. So although not all of these texts are strictly speaking part of the text corpus of the single intention, I regard them as textual witnesses for the formative period of the single intention, and therefore included them in my research. So as you might have already noticed, for the just mentioned texts, we have to think in terms of many authors rather than a single one. And therefore, for the sake of convenience, I refer to all these authors together as the single intentionists, which is a term that has been already introduced by Dan Martin and corresponds well to the Tibetan term Gongchikpa. So relying on these materials, I will try to answer two questions in the course of my presentation. The first is, how did Jigten Sumgon and his immediate disciples understand and present Buddha nature? And the second question is, how did they incorporate this presentation in their general system of a single intention underlying all the Buddha's teachings? In order to answer these questions, I'll guide you through six sections of my paper. Which are arranged according to major themes regarding Buddha nature that I could identify in the single intention. The first of these deals with the general identification of Buddha nature offered by the single intentionists. The second then introduces the single intentionist's defense of a single potential, a single vehicle, and a single result. The third discusses Buddha nature's permanence. The fourth seeks to shed light on the interrelation between Buddha nature and emptiness. The fifth discusses the qualities that Buddha nature is thought to be endowed with. And the sixth finally centers around the controversial statement that Buddha nature is a virtue worth of dedication. So in order to understand how the single intentionists define Buddha nature, we first have to consider their understanding of true reality as a fundamental nature, or shibab. This fundamental nature is what forms the basis for their formulation of a single intention, a single teaching, and as we will see shortly, also a single potential, a single vehicle, and a single result. This fundamental nature is introduced in what is in most versions of the single intention, the first vajra statement of the first chapter on the turnings of the wheel of Dharma in the Tibetan title is Chögyal Nedugi Tsom. And so here it reads, it is maintained that all the teachings of the Buddha only unveil the original state of the fundamental nature. And then in the commentaries on this vajra statement, it is said that if one has mastered the meaning of this one single statement, one has mastered the meaning of all the remaining vajra statements of the single intention. So on this point, Rinchen Jangchub explains, in accord with this way, the turnings of the wheel of Dharma are said to teach the original state of the fundamental nature. If one understands the meaning of that, nothing is left to understand regarding the entire 150 ways of the single intention. So, and then it is said that this fundamental nature is actually nothing else but Buddha nature. Therefore, we can say that Buddha nature, just like fundamental nature, is really right at the heart of the whole single intention. This is also supported by the opening verse of the Tekchen Tempe Ningbo, which is usually considered only second in importance to the single intention. I quote, the topic of the Muni's teachings is the Buddha element of sentient beings, the naturally pure, unchanging Dharmakaya. It is obscured by the clouds of ignorance in the cycle of existence. Through purification of these, the undefiled Nirvana is achieved. So according to the authors of the single intention, the only purport of the Buddha's teaching activity is to bring beings to this realization of their fundamental nature, that is their Buddha nature. The fact that this single subject can be referred to by many different names is evident from the great number of terms to denote Buddha nature that are used in the early commentaries of the single intention. The following are just some of the most prevalent ones that I have come across in the commentaries on the single intention. They include Buddha element, potential, absolute bodhicitta, Dharmakaya, nature of mind, all bases, true reality, limit of reality, ultimate virtue, primordially existing virtue, emptiness, dependent origination, and Mahamudra. And as we have already seen yesterday, we could also include many other terms like luminosity, for instance. So with these synonyms and the importance of Buddha nature for the single intentionists in mind, let us now turn to the question, who actually possesses Buddha nature? And here the answer of the single intentionists could simply be put as all beings. And The lack of an exception for this general rule is the topic of two similar vajra statements, namely vajra statement 129 and 130, which center around the defense of a single potential, a single vehicle, and a single result. The first of these, vajra statement 129, contains a refusal of the ultimate distinction into various potentials and paths. It reads, although people claim that the three vehicles are ascertained as three different causes, paths and results, here it is maintained that all vehicles are of a single potential and a single vehicle. In the commentaries on this point, various models of classifying sentient beings' potential are mentioned, most prominently the fourfold division as taught in Mahayana Sutra Alamkara 3.6 and the twofold division taught in Uttara Tantra 149. With regard to these, Dorje Shirab sorts possible potentials then into three groups, namely the perfectly certain, the Yangdaba Ngepa, the falsely certain, Lokpa Ngepa, and the uncertain Mangepa. The perfectly certain potential is comprised then of the potential of the Shravakas, the potential of the Pratyeka Buddhas, and the potential of the Bodhisattvas. Falsely certain corresponds to those with great desire, Dzogchenpa, and the uncertain refers to those who can be altered by conditions. So for the single intentionists, such a division into various potentials exists only temporarily, and it does not follow that any of these beings never achieves Buddhahood. Even those with great desire, it is said, who are sometimes also referred to as without potential, are said to nevertheless possess a tiny virtuous seed through which they will eventually attain Buddhahood, the only difference being the time it takes. So according to the single intentionists, the ultimate existence of various potentials is only mistakenly read into certain passages of the Chittamatra texts, such as the Mahayana Sutra Alamkara. Moreover, Dorje Shirab offers an explanation of the Uttara Tantra's differentiation into a naturally present potential, the Rangshin Nerik, and the potential acquired through practice, the Druperik. According to him, the first refers to Buddha nature, the naturally pure Buddha element as present in all sentient beings. Thus, he concludes, on the causal level, all sentient beings are of a single Mahayana potential. The latter then refers to the three trainings on the paths, which are, as all sentient beings are Mahayanists, nothing but the single Mahayana vehicle. Still, in the context of Vajra Statement 129, Dorje Shirab makes clear that since there is only a single Mahayana potential on the causal level, it follows that also the division into a Shravaka vehicle, a Pratyeka Buddha vehicle, and a Bodhisattva vehicle must be only temporary. In reality, for the single intentionists, there is only one path, namely the Mahayana. Having thus established a single potential and a single vehicle, Vajra Statement 130 then picks up two cases of beings who might usually be believed not to attain enlightenment, namely the Shravakas and those with wrong craving. And here it is said, although it is said that Shravakas and those with wrong craving do not attain Buddhahood, and although Shravakas are said to be a permanent obstacle, here, meaning in the single intention, it is maintained that the Muni's intention is that even those with wrong craving and the Shravakas finally achieve the great awakening. While the content of both commentaries to this Vajra statement is quite similar to the previous one, it seems to focus more strongly on the possibility to attain the result, that is Buddhahood. So together we can say that Vajra Statements 129 and 130 seek to establish a single potential, a single vehicle, and a single result. And I suppose that while this singularity of potential, vehicle, and result is a standard Madhyamaka teaching, it is treated in such detail in the single intention because it lays the foundation for establishing the unchanging nature of Buddha nature and all its synonyms, which then subsequently contributes significantly to the agenda of the single intention. The affirmation of a single potential, a single vehicle, and a single result also serves the single intentionists to establish Buddha nature as permanent. For them, Buddha nature is permanent or unchangeable in the sense that it exists equally at the time of ordinary beings with their single potential, at the time of the single path when practicing the three trainings, and at the time of the single result, the stage of complete Buddhahood. After having identified Buddha nature with the resultant level of the ultimate Bodhi of the Buddha, the Dharmakaya, Dodje Sherab seeks to delineate this permanence from the permanent self in the non-Buddhist doctrines of Atman. And here he writes, although it exists, it does not become the permanence of the heretics, since it is not the existence within the eight extremes. The way the ultimate Dharmakaya of the Buddha is permanent is because being an abandonment of the wrong with regard to true reality. So in this statement, Dorje Shirab points at another reason for the permanence of Buddha nature, namely that it is an abandonment. And that such a permanence is nevertheless compatible with dependent origination is addressed in the great Dikung teaching to the assembly. Here it reads, where then one might wonder if such a Buddha element, which is not produced by causes and not destroyed by conditions, is compatible with dependent origination. In fact, it is the basis for dependent origination. An example is space, which, although being neither produced by causes nor destroyed by conditions, is the basis for the entire environment and its inhabitants. In the same way, that Buddha element is the basis for dependent origination of samsara and nirvana. End of quote. So, just like space is permanent and still serves as the basis for the world, Buddha nature, although permanent due to not being produced by causes and not being destroyed by conditions, still serves as the basis for both samsara and nirvana. So, in sum, we can say that the single intentionists seem to regard Buddha nature as permanent because, for one, it exists equally at the time of the ground, at the time of the path and the result, then because it is an abandonment, and because it is neither produced by causes nor destroyed by conditions. Let us now move on to the relation between Buddha nature and emptiness. We have seen that the single intentionists regard Buddha nature as the basis for both samsara and nirvana, and have already mentioned that they generally equate it with emptiness. However, they seek to distinguish their view from what they call a mere emptiness, thongni kona, meaning an emptiness without any inherent qualities. So when reporting their own position, both commentators, Rinchen Jangchub and Dorje Sherab, refer to the lines of the Shimada Devi Sutra as quoted in the Ratnagotra Vibhaga Vyakya and summarized in Uttara Tanta 1.155. Everybody knows it, but I will still read it out. The Buddha element is empty of the adventitious defilements that bear the characteristic of being separable from it. It is not empty of the unsurpassable qualities that bear the characteristic of being inseparable from it. And on this point, Dorje Shirab explains. He says, since Buddha nature does not abide co-emergently with any of the defilements, it is known as being separable. Since it is not tainted by the defilements and isolated from them, it is empty of the sheets of defilements. Since it is not distinct from all the qualities of dissociation and maturation, it is known as being inseparable. Since it abides inseparable from all the primordial Buddha qualities, it is inseparable. Since it is full of Buddha qualities more numerous than the sands in the banks of the Ganga, it is not empty. So from that we can infer that for the single intentionists, Buddha nature has two aspects, one which is empty and separable from the adventitious stains, and one which is not empty and inseparable from the Buddha qualities. Jigden Sumgon also refers to these two aspects as the aspect of emptiness and the aspect of purity. to sum up, as far as the relation between Buddha nature and emptiness is concerned, we can say that as long as emptiness is understood as being endowed with qualities, it's a synonym of Buddha nature. A mere emptiness, however, can only be said to be one constituent of Buddha nature. As we have seen, the single intentionists describe Buddha nature positively as being endowed with qualities. These qualities are thought to exist fully developed and without exception from beginningless time, even at the time of the ground, the state of ordinary beings. Moreover, there is no hint that I understand any of these qualities to exist only in a subtle form or as being subject to a process of growth. In the single intention, the question of Buddha qualities is mainly treated during the course of three successive Vajra statements, 126, 127, and 128. In these Vajra statements, certain sets of qualities are established to equally exist at the level of the ground, at the level of the path, and at the level of the result. The first of these Vajra statements is 126, and here it says, although people claim that Sugata essence, the naturally pure element, is taught as emptiness, here, in the single intention, it is maintained that the naturally pure element possesses the qualities of the result of dissociation. So Vajra statement 126 centers around the set of 32 qualities of dissociation, the 10 strengths, the 4 fearlessnesses, and the 18 unique qualities, which together with the 32 qualities of maturation build a pair of qualities that is usually associated with the level of the result, that is Buddhahood. The single intentionists, however, maintain that all of these qualities equally exist on the levels of the ground, path, and result. What they mean by qualities is therefore both the qualities of dissociation and the qualities of maturation. In Vajra statement 127, a similar case evolves around a group of 37 factors of awakening. According to the general view, as reported in Doshema and Jinjangma, others view these factors to be practiced and acquired along the four paths of learning, and maintain that just like a boat or a bridge that can be left behind after a river has successfully been crossed, they are only required on the path, but that they are neither exist at the time of the ground, nor are they required at the time of the result. The single intentionists, however, again maintain that they exist equally on all the three levels. While Vajra statement 126 and 127 were concerned with sets of qualities that are mainly associated with the stages of the result and the path, respectively, Vajra statement 128 then centers around another set of qualities, namely those of the four immeasurables, that are sometimes believed to be a worldly path and as such lead only to worldly results. Here, the single intentionist's view is just as in the previous Vajra statements, since they maintain that the four immeasurables exist equally on all the three levels of ground, path, and result. Although the term is not used in the two early commentaries on the single intention, in the context of Vajra statement 7.15, Rigtsen Chödrak, in his 17th century commentary, states that Buddha nature is endowed with a twofold purity, Thakpa Niden, meaning it is free from both the obscurations of defilements and the obscurations to the objects of knowledge. Let us now turn to Vajra statement 4.23, which states that all roots of virtue of samsara and nirvana are to be dedicated. For the single intentionists, this encompasses two kinds of virtues, namely the virtue performed or accumulated by oneself and all other sentient beings, as well as primordially existing virtue. Within these, primordially existing virtue is identified with Buddha nature, and Rinchen Zhangchub states, What we call primordially existing virtue refers to what is equivalent to and the same as the naturally pure Buddha element, Sugata essence, and the Dharmakaya of the Buddha within sentient beings. These two kinds of virtues are compared to the ocean and its waves. While performed virtue is said to be like waves on the ocean's surface, primordially existing virtue is said to be like the ocean itself. Regarding the latter, primordially existing virtue, two views that are opposed to this are brought up in the early commentaries on the single intention, namely that Buddha nature is not a virtue and that it cannot be dedicated. The first objection, therefore, concerns Buddha nature being a virtue. And it is said that since Buddha nature is a synonym of emptiness, it cannot be positioned as virtue. When presenting the single intentionist's reply, Rinchen Zhangzhu points to the two aspects of Buddha nature. And he writes, here the intention of the father and his spiritual sons is that although the empty true reality, which like space, cannot be categorized as virtue or non-virtue, is one aspect of Tathagata essence, there's another aspect which is not empty. So reference is made here to the previously mentioned two aspects of Buddha nature, namely the empty aspect which could be said to be neither virtue nor non-virtue, and the aspect of full of virtuous Buddha qualities. The single intentionists seem to thus argue that since emptiness is only one of two aspects of Buddha nature, this neither virtue nor non-virtue character of emptiness does not contradict Buddha nature as a whole being a virtue. The second objection concerns Buddha nature being fit for dedication. It is said that since dedication means to change something from one state into another, and since true reality is unchanging, it follows that it cannot be dedicated. If it was changing, however, Buddha nature would have to be impermanent. Confronted with this objection, the single intentionists argue that this would have to be true for all phenomena, since in the Shatasahasrika Prajnaparamita, it is said that like true reality is unchanging, all phenomena are also ultimately unchanging. In a nutshell, what the single intentionists presumably want to convey is that every single goodness, up to and including the most fundamental goodness underlying all sentient beings, can be utilized for awakening. Thus, the initial statement of Buddha nature being a virtue worth of dedication, as formulated in the early commentaries on the single intention, reads, at least to me, more like a practical advice rather than a philosophical statement. So I come to my conclusion. What I have attempted to do in my paper is to briefly present the single intentionist's understanding of the notion of Buddha nature. Three essential points may be made regarding their description of Buddha nature. First, Buddha nature is thought to exist in all beings without exception from beginningless time, and even the lowest of all will eventually reach the state of Buddhahood. Second, Buddha nature has to be understood as the union of two aspects, namely emptiness and qualities. Thus, although Buddha nature is empty in the sense of being free from the extremes of proliferation, it is at the same time endowed with the complete Buddha qualities. Then third, since Buddha nature is permanent and unchanging, all its qualities exist fully developed throughout the levels of ground, path, and result. However, in order to actualize them, beings have to undergo a process of purifying the defilements. When defilements are purified, that is Buddhahood. Regarding my second question, namely how the single intentionists incorporate their presentation of Buddha nature into their system of a single intention, we could see that the notion of Buddha nature and the notion of a single intention are inseparably linked to each other. Thus, although there are vajra statements in the single intention that directly concern Buddha nature, the topic in fact pervades the whole text, since all teachings of the Buddha can be said to be for the single purpose of guiding beings to the realization of their Buddha nature. As we could see, Buddha nature, with its synonyms of fundamental nature and dependent origination, as well as with their two aspects of emptiness and qualities, or freedom from proliferation and cause and result, are what comprises the true reality of samsara and nirvana. This single true reality, whether we call it Buddha nature, fundamental nature, dependent origination, or any of the other synonyms, then in turn leads the single intentionist to propose a single potential, a single vehicle, and a single result, and in the end, a single intention. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for your very clear presentation. And I see you already.
Well, thank you very much for this excellent analysis and summary of the Dongchi and Buddha nature in the Dongchi. And you clearly worked out that there is a notion of a permanent and unchanging existence of Buddha qualities and the Buddha nature. This, of course, raises normally an objection that, you know, like something positive cannot really be permanent. So my question is this permanence somehow qualified by something like Kimi Chupa, or is it like a true permanence?
That's a good question, thank you. It is not really, there's no answer, I think, to your question in the early commentaries on the single intention. What seems to me, at least, to be the main reason for them for saying that Buddha nature is permanent is really this being not dependent on causes, and not that it cannot be destroyed by conditions and causes and so forth. I think this is what they just quote the Uttara Tantra, and they simply state it is unchanging because of these three reasons that I have mentioned here. It is not further described what kind of permanence they really mean with that.
But it seems, you know, this is the basis for Kudosawa's development of the idea of Buddha nature as a continuous flow.
That could very well be possible, yeah. In general, my feeling, so to say, is that these early commentaries really just the basis for what comes later in Tibetan history. Like, there were so many cases where I was really looking for an answer for a particular question, and when I asked scholars of the Jigong tradition today, they always refer to later authors like Rangjung Dorje, or sometimes even to Mikyo Dorje and later Kagyu proponents. So I think many of these questions are not really answered in these early texts.
Yeah, thank you for this very clear presentation. Mm. Eva, I missed it, or you didn't mention it, or it's not mentioned at all in the text, as usual. Mm-hmm. But who brings up the objection that Buddha nature is ultimate virtue? You know, because I mean, that's just a reflection of the Lanka Avatara Sutra, yeah?
You mean that it's not an ultimate?
Not.
Who brings that up? No, that's like in the Gongcheng, we always have this structure with a general opinion, the Chishe, and then we have the opinion of the Gongcheng Pass. But it's usually not really clear who is the opponent here. And it seems to me that sometimes it's just really a general misunderstanding that could arise on a certain point. Sometimes I heard in one case it's mentioned that there's only one person in Tibet who really holds this view, and that was this and that student of Jigden Sumgen. So sometimes it's really could be only one single person. Sometimes it is said that the previous Vajra statement could be understood in a wrong way. That's why Jigden Sumgen taught this next Vajra statement. So I think it's really, we cannot say it, like in the case of dedication and ultimate virtue, I don't think that they really mean Sakya Pandita here. I think that's much later, or at least a bit later. And I think here it's really only presenting their view, and not so much any opposing opinion, or at least we cannot pinpoint it and say this is now Sakya teaching or whatever.
Maybe there's a little chance to find out who it could have been in Mikyo Dorje's commentaries, because he sometimes tries to track down
the author of the fiction. Right, I remember also that on this point of dedication, there is a section in Mikyo Dorje's commentary on the Ngontuk Yen, where he really tries to defend Buddha nature being an ultimate virtue and being worth of dedication and so on. But I think that's much later. I think what they do here is just, they just quote a general opinion that might have existed at the time, but not particularly any scholar from a certain tradition or anything like that.
Yeah. Thanks. I have a comment and then a question. So my comment is, like you said, you know, this text is being interpreted through these later scholars, maybe different than, you know, these early students. So I'm wondering if you say, like, Buddha nature used as the organizing principle of the text, except the only time they're using like Pinpo, you're translating as Buddha essence. So in the beginning you say the Shion Pakki Melu is the equals Buddha nature, and then you give this list of synonyms. But I wonder if that is really the guiding structure of Buddha nature, or is it something else like this Shion Pakki Melu or some of these other terms? And is it not maybe the later commentators that organized this around Buddha nature? But that's just a comment, maybe you can respond to that. But my question is, in terms of, it's related to all the synonyms that you gave for Buddha nature, and one of them, Pratitya Samuppada. But I wonder, though, about that, because I think that's something that needs to be established or argued for. Because you said that it was permanent, Buddha nature was permanent, and that some people say that Buddha nature just refers to emptiness, but we say this. And then there was another statement about the ground of dependent origination. Oh, it's compatible with dependent origination because it's its ground, but that doesn't mean it's a synonym. So I'm just wondering if it's worked out in this text or in this early strata, and because I'm interested in this Kagyu Jonam relationship between Buddha nature and the static permanence, or whether there's a more dynamic kind of compatible dependent origination. So if you have any response to this.
Well, concerning your first point, the relation between Buddha nature and this fundamental nature, you're right that the most clear statement really equating these two is from Rigtsen Shujak's commentary, so a much later commentary. But still, I think that in like what I saw in the early text is that it is not stated as like it is Dönchik, like really saying it, but dependent origination is also referred to as the whole crux of the Buddha's teachings. Like all the Buddha's teachings can be summarized as dependent origination. That is very clear in these early texts. And then it is also said that dependent origination has these two components. Emptiness or freedom from proliferation, it's called Tagye Dantempe, Tagye Danteve Denje, and the aspect of cause and result, the Yudeki Tendre. So that's very clear in the early texts. And then these two are in other sections of the Dzogchen, for example, in the Dzogchen Tempo, also referred to as Shi or Shibab. So I think it's even in these early texts, they are not in the sense of Dönchik and Chigina, Chigimbe, Kyab, and so on, but they are equated in the early texts, I think. That's at least was my impression now by reading them.
And just in time for a short question, please. Thank you for the presentation. I was also thinking about this synonyms or other synonyms. Generally, in your study, I was wondering if you try to also try to explain why certain ideas are found in your authors' work. For example, if you look at this list, I have a feeling that it's based on some earlier sources, so whether you are able to find such sources or not. For instance, the Gomchik authors, do they cite Kunjigyalpo sometimes?
Do they what?
Kunjigyalpo, do they cite Kunjigyalpo? Any evidence that they knew Kunci Gelbo? Because the Kunci Gelbo, they have a host of synonyms, and because you can see Bolichita, etc. Seems very familiar. Familiar is kind of a positive synonym to this.
Okay.
I was wondering if you have some sort of, if he's drawing some ideas from other existing sources.
I have to say that this list is not cannot be found in the early texts as such.
But it's only
I mean, what I did is I read the early Gongchi commentaries, the Rinzhang Ma and Dorje Ma, and then the Zhokzhi Chemo. I'm also translating in another project, so I basically read through the whole text and I just noted down any terms to denote Buddha nature that I found there. So this list is not. This is my own list, right? It's not Jigten Sungren's list. So that's why I think it can also be extended. It's not that this is. It's only these 10 points, but there are many more. I think that can be found in the early commentaries, and they don't have the tendency to give lists and definitions and speak of synonyms and so forth. It's very rare that you find anything close to a definition as we understand it.
One slight thing with this Gyoha, it's such a problematic concept of something absolute and still considered Gyoha, Kushala, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking, I had a suspicion that, for instance, in Abhidhamma Samuchaya and so on, in Indian sources, already have some kind of very unusual way of understanding Gyoha and Gyoha.
Mm-hmm.
And if the Tibetan scholars conflate it, and then of course the critiques has a certain kind of notion of Gyoha,
mm-hmm.
and the proponent may have a different, and then we just criticize without actually trying to understand how this word has been used. For example, samsara is called Demnambi, you may have Demnambi or Gyoha or something like that, but this is a completely different sort of parameter of Gyoha and Gyoha.
Mm-hmm.
Here I'm feeling that a certain kind of idea has been used to characterize this people or whatever as Gyoha,
mm-hmm.
and not in a normal
I think it
would be very important. I mean, it seems very significant in your work to just try to distinguish this concept of
Gyoha.
Thank you.
One more short, very short comment.
All right. Thank you very much. When the text is talking about not just one intention, but the single vehicle here as well, what are its sources, or is anything mentioned there? So you mentioned the shamara being called upon in another context. When it comes to Ekayana, are any texts cited there?
Oh, I haven't. The commentaries are quite long, and there are so many quotations. So I'm sorry, I cannot provide any list now of the sources they mentioned. But
the only reason I say is just that in the Lotus Sutra once, in the Tibetan, there is Bomachi.
Right. They definitely on the. On the single intention, what they quote a lot is the Samadhi Raja Sutra, where it said that all teachings have different wording but the same meaning. So, and then it goes on like, I have taught all dharmas as a single meaning. So that's the most prevalent quote that they give in all the commentaries on the Gongchi for this single intention.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.